You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Hit the road, Jack. Ray Charles. If you've never seen the movie Ray, you might want to take it in. Very good movie. And who is it? Jamie Foxx does. He's awesome in it. And the music's great. Yeah. Just if you get the soundtrack to it, if it's Ray Charles, pretty awesome. All right. Out to Iwo Jima.
We interrupt the program now in progress.
All right, what we'll do is we're going to go from, we're going to hear about, we'll hear how Americans heard about it. And I got a couple emails this morning about the FBI. Let me just make this comment about the FBI. It's not enough to apologize when 70 people get killed. So, a lot of people want a pound of flesh from the FBI, and it's well deserved. What do you say? In this case, on two separate occasions, and I want to play a little bit of a piece of audio from last week before, and I was talking about. Is it too much for me to think that the FBI, given this guy's name, the unique spelling, would plug it into a criminal database, firearms database? You see a guy who's 19, just bought an AR-15. Is it too much to me to put those two pieces of data and to call an office and say, hey, could you run this to ground for us? Is that too much? And now, you know, somebody with every bit of intelligence they needed to stop this calls, and somehow or other, you know, I guess we'll learn how that thing slipped through the cracks. And I just, you know, again, your heart breaks for the parents who hear this, knowing that if the FBI did their job, that this probably wouldn't happen. Their kid would not be dead. So this is Judge Andrew Napolitano, who appears on Fox. And I want to play you the audio from this is from last week.
You've been listening to authorities, including the local law enforcement chief and the FBI assigned to that.
That's obviously Neil Cavuto.
Area over this apparent stunning development here where the FBI never acted on a tip about Nicholas Cruz and a detailed tip of that back on January 5th of this year. Now, we don't know who provided the tip on this tip line, but very, very detailed concerns about Cruz's increasingly erratic behavior, about the fact that he might harm people, that his social media postings were getting decidedly more violent in tone and in nature, his abuse of animals, particularly small animals. This was spelled on a quite detailed and long, almost a diatribe, that was supposed to go to the FBI's Miami field office, either never did or never advanced from there. And it warranted an apology today from the present FBI director and already Governor Rick Scott of Florida has called for his head, says he should resign. On the phone with us right now is Judge Andrew Napolitano. Judge, how big a deal is this getting to be? Because at first when we heard it, we thought the reference was to that infamous September posting on the part of a guy who certainly sounded like Cruz, talking up a possible school shooting. This is a lot more detail months later, 6 weeks ago. What do you think?
I think it's a huge deal, Neil, and it comes, after a couple of weeks which have not been good for the FBI, not been good for the FBI because of political bias, which has been demonstrated really beyond any doubt. But now we see really malfeasance in office, which results in the death of 17 individuals. Now, I understand what the sheriff said. There's nobody responsible for these deaths but the person who actually did the killing. But the ball was seriously dropped twice here. And in both instances, if they had just done their jobs, if they had just followed protocol, they would have been able to stop this from happening. The one in Mississippi, once they had his name, they can run it through their database. Their database would say, gee, there's a guy with this name,
right,
who lives in Florida, who just bought an AR-15. Let's go talk to him. That would have alerted them to him.
Who knew Napolitano listened to All Marine Radio?
But the dropping of the ball of these very, very detailed and persistent complaints, I've not seen anything like this in recent years, Neil.
Well, obviously, to your point, and even the FBI director agrees with you right now, saying that certain protocols were disrupted, and we're going to get to the bottom of it. But it comes at a time when people are wondering how agencies communicate information. And that was a 9/11 phenomenon, right? I mean, where the agencies, the FBI, the CIA, they weren't talking to each other. Or in the case of the Boston Patriot Day bombing, that the authorities in Washington had information on the Cernan brothers behind that attack, weren't communicating that to local police. But this still seems to be going on.
Not only is it going on, Neil, this is not a communication from a local county sheriff to
right,
the FBI.
Right.
This is from one FBI office to another FBI office. The vaunted FBI, which we keep calling the greatest law enforcement agency in the United States, is unworthy of that name because of this incident, combined with the other things that we talked about earlier. And Governor Scott, it may be political, it may be emotional, but it's moral and it's rational for him to say there has to be serious changes at the top. How could this possibly have happened?
Judge, while I have you, apples and oranges concerning the FBI or Justice Department now with indicting these 13 Russian nationals for meddling in the 2016 election.
Okay, that's a different issue. With September 11th and all that, it was the CIA and the FBI not talking to each other. And, we watched, played audio from a special done earlier this year, The Road to 9/11, which the gunner, turned us on to. And the FBI agent so frustrated with the CIA that they did not post, that they did not share information on two of the guys who got on airliners. And if they would have shared that, they probably could have traced them to others. And who knows, maybe they could have stopped that. In this case, what we're talking about is the FBI not even communicating internally. And I didn't know I talked to a couple law enforcement guys again over the weekend, and they're like, Matt, come on. That might be. So you get a tip on a school shooter and what is the profile of every one of these shooters? They're young people. They're not adults that go into the schools. They're young people. Okay. So are you going to find them in a database for felons? Probably not. But where might you find them? You're probably going to find them in a gun database. Anybody with that kind of unique spelling under the age of 20 buy a weapon recently? That's not, they're pros at this. You're not. And you figured it the fuck out. You think they ought to be able to? So the answer is, well, yes, they probably get this kind of stray voltage all the time. They obviously took it seriously in Mississippi, but they half-assed it. And then the second tip, they just completely blew it out their ass. So the FBI, really, the FBI has to prove to the country that they're worthy of the respect that we give them. And again, I'm one of the people that says, hey, look, this political stuff that's at the top of the FBI, the rank and file FBI, well, this is the rank and file. So now that disease is spread to the rank and file. So, I mean, I remember being in the Marine Corps when the Clayton Lone Tree thing happened, and Time put us on the cover of Time magazine with the Marine, the first to fight Marine, except that guy had a black eye. And it was embarrassing, you know. And so the FBI, they've got a ways to go to go ahead and restore the nation's faith in their ability to do what the hell they do. So anyway, wanted to play that for you. All right, so here's what you're going to hear now. This is, you're going to hear a couple of reports from news reports that the nation heard. And so you'll hear the news report, and then you'll hear a series of audio clips that were done by correspondents that were embedded on battleships, some on ships going ashore, or Amtrak's going ashore, and then some ashore. So you'll hear that audio, and then you'll go ahead and we got a little bit of oral history. So Iwo Jima, we'll talk about it this week. As we talk about Hawaii, as we talk about Tet. You know, again, I'll just make this comment about Tet, because I saw a sign about, I live in an area that has a lot of Vietnamese people, and it is Tet. Tet is the Lunar New Year. And so they celebrate. But, you know, as a Marine, when you see Tet, you think of one thing. You know, you think of it as the Tet Offensive. That's how it's labeled, right? We should change that label. Right? They were annihilated. Think about that. South Vietnamese and United States military, for the most part, right, completely surprised by the offensive. And what happened? Right? They bounced back from the surprise, and they literally annihilated the Viet Cong. Yeah, they were destroyed. I think you could make the case that by the verb, the mission is when you give somebody a mission to destroy this force, the Viet Cong were destroyed as a force. And the NVA were not capable of extended offensive operations until 1972, 4 years later. They could fake them. They could do economy of force stuff. But, yeah, they got their asses kicked. But we don't, the Tet Offensive, yeah. The Tet disaster for North Vietnamese, for the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. And they would tell you that too. So anyhow, we don't talk about it like that. Anyway, but I digress. All right, so here you go. First news bulletins in the United States, Iwo Jima.
We interrupt the program now in progress to bring you a special report from Guam. This report will come to you via special military facilities and is being released at this time to the combined American networks. Now for the special news from Advanced Naval Headquarters, far out in the Pacific, we take you to Guam. Go ahead, Guam.
The following communique has this minute been issued by C.W. Nimitz, Fleet Admiral, U.S. Navy, Commander-in-Chief, U.S. Pacific Fleet and Pacific Ocean Areas. The communique. Vice Admiral Mark A. Mitcher is in command of a powerful task force of the Pacific Fleet, is now attacking enemy aircraft, air bases, and other military targets in and around Tokyo. Surface units of the Pacific Fleet are bombarding Iwo Jima. Aircraft of the Strategic Air Force Pacific Ocean Areas are bombing Iwo Jima and nearby positions in the balloons. The fleet forces are under the tactical command of Admiral R.A. Spruance, Commander, 5th Fleet. This is Art Friend returning you to the United States.
This is Leslie Nichols speaking from a back.
All right, now the next one, two, three, four clips are of are of a gentleman who's, you heard his name, Leslie Nichols. He's aboard one of the U.S. battleships, that's off the coast of Iwo Jima.
This is Leslie Nichols speaking from a battleship which is not far off the volcano island. We have just come under attack, and our guns have opened up. And just now, our guns, or at least the guns of one of the forts, have shot down an enemy plane. It has fallen over on the horizon, just ahead of us. We're steaming in the direction of it. And now it appears that we can see just the remnants of the plane burning on the water up ahead. I can dimly make out in the light of a little more than a new moon the shadows of the other ships around us. There go our guns again. High up on the foremast tower of this battleship. There's a great deal of smoke around the fort. You just heard our 5-inch shells go again. That is a report that planes are circling the ship. We may open up at any moment. There seems to be an enemy plane off the port beam directly across from me here.
How about that? The reporter using the term port beam. For those of you who don't know, that's left side amidship in the middle. You know what? Pretty amazing. You know, the Navy. At that point, Navy, in terms of services with numbers of casualties, number one, United States Army, number two, United States Navy, number three, United States Marine Corps.
That concludes this broadcast from a battleship with the 5th Fleet, some 60 miles off the island of Iwo Jima. And just now, here's a flash report. The Admiral of our group tells us that we deserve a well done for having shot down that damn plane. And you ought to see the gunners and all the crew of this mighty battleship rejoicing now, because it happens to be their first damn plane.
All right, now the next audio you're going to hear is ship-to-shore movement.
And now we're streaking in to the line of departure. That means we are going to the line from which we will shortly leave. You can hear our motor, the engine of this tank glider, roaring as we move quickly through the water up to a distance of about 2,000 yards from the shore.
You know, we see those images all the time of Marines and Amtraks, right, with the island in the background, you know, their heads peering over, you know, the edge of the Amtrak. And, you know, it's crazy to think that, you know, this guy is in and amongst them doing play-by-play.
There's all hell to pay directly ahead of us. The beach looks as though it's practically on fire.
What was that?
Huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, we can see machine guns on the cliff now. Directly ahead of us, firing out at us. Boy, they're coming straight at us now. I think we're a little out of their range. I'm not sure. I hope so. The fire, the whole wall is covered with smoke. The terrific roar around us is coming from, mostly from our own amphibious tractors. There go American dive bombers going down on the beach, back of the beach. We can see the beach very clearly now. I'll tell you one thing I'm thinking right now of, my home, of my wife and my little daughter, and I hope they're all right. And I hope I come back to them all right. That's about what you think of now. I tried to get some of these men to talk, but I know deep down that's what they're thinking of. And now we're streaking in to the line of departure. That means we are going to the line from which we will shortly leave. You can hear our motor, the engine of this tank lighter roaring as we move quickly through the water up to a distance of about 2,000 yards from the shore.
Okay, you heard the segment. This is one continual piece of the audio, and it's much longer. So some of it's a little redundant, but bear with him. Right? He was busy that day.
There's all hell to pay directly ahead of us. The beach looks as though it's practically on fire. We've now heard word that casualties in those first waves were very light. The terrific roar around us is coming from mostly from our own amphibious tractors. There go American dive bombers going down on the beach, back of the beach. We can see the beach very clearly now. I'll tell you one thing I'm thinking right now of my home, of my wife and my little daughter, and I hope they're all right. And I hope I come back to them all right. That's about what you think of now. I've tried to get some of these men to talk, and I know deep down that's what they're thinking of. All their big Jap stuff dropping in the water up ahead of us a little. We'll probably have to go through it. There's great clouds of black smoke. What is that? Huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, we can see machine guns on the cliff now. Directly ahead of us, firing out at us. Boy, they're coming straight at us now. I think we're a little out of their range. I'm not sure. I hope so. The fire, the whole wall is covered with smoke. There we've hit it. We're grounding on it. We're up on it. We're up on it. In a minute, the ramp will go down, and the men are going to scream out. The man, Tom, has just wished everybody good luck. Everybody's sort of... The machine gun just fired. Our machine gun just fired. Something's half shot. 3 or 4 shots. You probably heard it. The men are now going out ahead. They're moving out ahead of the half track. Boy, it's up to my knees. I think my pistol got wet. I don't know. Pretty high. I'm moving away from the half track now. The men are motioning me further to move forward. The surface of the coral is quite level. Although it's bumpy, but it's not, at least not jagged, not full of foam. What's the matter? Hey, spread out! Spread out! Hey, John! Nice to be in there with you. There's a lot of fire coming in this water, but no one I've seen yet has been hit, fortunately. It's amazing you can't see anyone in the beach. You also see a marine running along.
Can you imagine? And it's amazing, after all these years, this stuff continues to bubble out of archives and things like that. We're going to get Charlie Niemeyer on, who we had on a couple weeks ago, but because of waiting for live audio, our visit was short with him. But we're going to get Charlie back on to talk about the way these things are continuing to bubble up as people pass away and people go through their personal effects and you know, all this, or you know, you get something like this. But play by play as they hit the beach on Iwo Jima is honestly unbelievable. And the next you're gonna hear is tank communications. You know? I mean, that's a company radio net, for God's sakes. And you're gonna hear them trying to find the lane that the engineers cleared to get off the beach. Yeah. 4th Tank Battalion.
Through the coconuts. Well, just one boy's been hit. One boy's been hurt now. They're putting him into the rubber boat. Four men putting him into the rubber boat. I don't know who it is. Can't see him. But he has been hurt. And he's lying on his side. Another boy's just been hurt. Another boy's been hit. But I think he can kill. The officer is firing at him to get him. No, he's all right. He's signed into the rubber boat. I guess he's all right. There's a lot of fire around us now. We're almost at shore. I should say about 100 feet or a little more from shore. There are 2 Marines now in our rubber boat. Another boy's just been hurt. He's hanging onto the tail with both arms. Hey, tell him to smile while they stick a guy in the tail. Oh, there's 1 Marine lying on his back now with the feet. There's one marine lying on his back with blood pouring out of him into the water. And here, we're reaching the beach now. We're going to come up on it. And there's fire all around us, and the Marines are still on the beach. They have not made any further headway. At least there's a whole multi-two waves here on the beach. In fact, all of the fast tracks are lined up now around us on the beach. None of them have been able to move past here. There go the corpsmen are walking around. They don't seem to be taking any cover. They're walking upright, looking for casualties, moving from one guy to the next. Men are jumping back and forth next to us. Now some of the Marines are motioning for the next wave to come in. And here comes another halfback behind us with men coming in after us. They're waiting too. I don't think we've left any men in the water.
We were going to hit the beach in just a couple of seconds.
All right, this is a different correspondent. And it's pretty amazing the second that they hit the beach.
So we're going to be quiet and trace our calls for the shot. And now we've hit the beach. Just simultaneously with that shell burst that you heard, we hit the beach.
This is Sergeant Dick Mawson, United States Marine Corps Combat Radio correspondent.
Okay, and you know, one of the things that you learn about the Marine Corps when you're around its history is the Marine Corps did something that other services didn't do, which is they organized their combat photographers and combat correspondents and had them out there recording, you know, what Marines were doing. And here's one of them. So we'll get his name. I'll start it from the beginning, but pretty interesting.
This is Sergeant Dick Mawson, United States Marine Corps Combat Radio correspondent with the Veteran 4th Division. Sergeant Harvey Williams, our control recording engineer, and I are speaking to you now from the Motoyama Airport number 1 on the island of Iwo Jima, the Sulphur Islands, after the 4th and 5th Divisions of the United States Marines landed to wrest this island from the Japanese and give Uncle Sam another base only 660 miles from the Japanese mainland itself.
For those of you who aren't familiar with the geography of Iwo Jima, if you kind of, from the pictures you've seen, on the left of the view from the water, you have Mount Suribachi. There's an airfield that sits kind of at the foot of Mount Suribachi. That's what he's referring to. Motoyama number 1, that's the southern airfield.
The fighting is going on a ridge just in front of us. You can probably hear the noise of the shelling in the planes overhead as they drop their bombs, and every once in a while you hear them scrape and send rockets down. As we look over on this ridge, the Marines have paths cut up the side of it to the top where the Japs are entrenched. You can probably hear the sound of that rocket barrage went off just then over on the ridge. And there's a scene of violent activity there as these Marines are going up and down that ridge, carrying supplies up to the men on the front lines and bringing casualties back out. And there are casualties, too. There are plenty of them. That's one of the Marine fighter planes just passed overhead. He's on his way back to his base to get a new supply of rockets. I notice he has rocket brackets on, but they are empty. A terrific bombardment just went on over that ridge. You can probably hear those planes strafing over there now. Quite a few planes are circling over that ridge. There's a new flight of about 15 or 20 of them coming in now from the south. And up to now, we haven't had any air opposition whatsoever. There hasn't been a single Japanese plane appear over the island. That swishing sound you heard is the rockets. They're moving. They let those rockets go back quite a ways behind the lines on the Jap emplacements. They put them over the ridge from us, and you can't hear them very well. They'll go two more planes down. The sound of those motors is too loud for you to hear very much the sound of those rockets. There goes another plane down. Let's see if we can hear it. I imagine you heard that one all right. That was a little bit closer. That landed on this side of the ridge, probably somewhere near the front of the Japanese lines. Plane circles around and goes back off to sea then and makes a wide circle and comes back in again. There are several planes in the sky overhead now, and they all seem to be making runs in. There goes a straight plane. It got rid of its ammunition, its rounds for that run, and it's gone back out to sea. And there goes another rocket plane down. It's interesting to watch these things if you're on the right side of the fence. I wouldn't care to be a Japanese and watching it right now. These planes peel off in the same way as a dive bomber does, heads down directly toward its target, and under each wing, you see a bright spot of light. and then a trail of fire and smoke comes out the front of the plane, pulls ahead, and down into the ground. You hear that terrible rushing, tearing sound as these rockets go down, and a terrific concussion as the rockets explode. Strangely enough, there's anti-aircraft fire in the air again. There's two black blobs of it. How they, those gun places can live through all that bombardment is something that's beyond me. They are well dug in, but in caves in the side of these hills, but still with all that terrific bombardment and with the naval gunfire throwing point blank at those cave openings, it's amazing how at this late date there can still be anti-aircraft emplacements to give trouble to the aviators. They've been using a lot of white phosphorus bombs on there, and the bomb explodes in a huge puff of white smoke in the air, and from the white smoke, hundreds of fingers of flame shoot out toward the objective. If you can appreciate that sort of thing in a setting like this, why, there it is. Personally, we'd rather see it in the newsreel.
Yeah, personally, we'd rather see it in a museum. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue. You're going to hear tanks trying to get off the beach on Iwo Jima. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with a serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On the 19th day of February, a sacred day in Marine Corps history. Marines that wrote one of the epic chapters, and really, which is the symbol of the Marine Corps, a symbol that you saw used after September 11th when firefighters were putting up a flag. You saw that image, you know, put up against the image of the flag raising on Iwo Jima, but a battle that's come to symbolize the Marine Corps, and 72 years ago today, F-18 guy, Kurt Knowles, his grandfather, fought on Iwo Jima. So, anyway, we salute those guys. You've heard Jess Humphrey. Cal Humphrey is his uncle. His father, Robert Humphrey, was a platoon commander on Vietnam. On Vietnam, on Iwo Jima. So, yeah, so you're a series of links, obviously, that run deep, certainly, here. These are a series of, short tank, conversations that happened. And again, the ironic part for me is, I know one of the guys that's one of the company commanders in 4th Tank Battalion. I had him on the air years ago and asked him about this audio. And he simply he talked about what they were trying to do as they tried to find a way off the beach. Ironically, they got told that, you know, you may not even go ashore given the prep that, you know, has been given this island. And then I want to say 3 hours into the battle on day one, they get told to, man their tanks, and they're going ashore. So, here it is. This is 4th Tank Battalion, and some of the most improbable audio that you've ever heard in your life. Yeah, not only that somebody was recording it. So, in thinking about it, I would imagine it was CBS or one of the media companies that had recording equipment that was on a ship off the coast, and they picked a net. Like, who should we go ahead and devote our limited recording assets to? And they, for whatever reason, they chose 4th Tank Battalion, and it must have survived in the CBS archive. It's the only thing I can think for years until somebody dug it out. But 4th Tank Battalion, on the morning of February 19th, 1945.
on those crackers.
We're trying to pick up the communications from the tanks, which have been lying in the shore, as they...
Hold it up. There's a gas.
Think how crazy it is to hear that stuff. You know, tank commanders, you know, directing somebody else's fire on targets on Iwo Jima that morning. I've got some more of that, and I'll play that for you. I want to play you though. This is a report filed from Guam on D+1. So this went back in the news to the United States.
At this very moment, American Marines are battling stiff resistance on the island of Iwo. This may be one of the toughest fights in the entire Pacific War. For details on the battle in progress, we take you now to Guam for a report by war correspondent Arthur Thrym, speaking for the combined American networks via special military facility. Go ahead, Guam.
This is Arthur Thrym.
Now imagine this. Imagine how revolutionary this is. In terms of telecommunications, that they're able to move audio and pictures as fast as have ever been moved in history.
Speaking from Pacific Fleet Headquarters at Guam, I have just returned from a breathtaking observation trip over the bitter battlefield at Iwo Jima in the Volcano Islands. And I can assure you that the fighting there is fierce and bloody. As we drew in close to the ground over the southern part of the island where the fighting is centered, we all sensed that below us was developing the most significant and grimmest battle of the Pacific War to date. Iwo Jima is 8 square miles of unadulterated hell, with hundreds of carrier-based planes in the air and more than 800 ships of all types and sizes standing offshore. We came in over Iwo at high noon. The weather was rough and the sea was rough, but through the driving rain we could find more ships than any of us had ever seen together before in our lives. Altogether, it was a mighty armada, but what caught our attention at once was the scores and scores of planes which filled the sky. Our carrier-based attacking force was made up mostly of Curtis Helldivers, Grumman Hellcats, and Grumman Avengers. On several occasions, we saw as many as 100 in the air at the same time. The two main objectives for our planes and surface vessels were the northern cliff of Mount Suribachi and the stone quarry which stands in the path of our northward advance. Dive bombers, torpedo bombers, and fighters would come in groups of fours, tens, twenties, and fifties and drop their bombs against the side of the cliff where the Japs are tunneled in. Many of the planes were carrying rockets, since we could hear them over their intercom system being ordered to launch their rockets against the face of the cliff. At one time, 22 peeled off from 7,000 feet and roared in to launch their rockets against Suribachi and strafe the defenders there. After their run was completed, the observer was heard to say, "Good work, right on the buck." While the planes were carrying out their bombing runs, battleships, cruisers, and destroyers standing offshore also pumped their high-velocity shells into the side of the perpendicular cliff. Great plumes of smoke, dust, and flames leap from the northern side of the volcano as if it were again erupting. Tsurabotsi Yama seems to leap and then settle back again. We obviously regard this as our number one target at the moment, and it's easy to see why. As long as the Japs are dug in on its cliffs, they control the entire southern plain of the island, which is now the scene of savage fight. We haven't lost many landing vessels on the beachhead, testifying to yesterday's official communique that the landing was made against slight resistance. None of our ships at sea had been damaged, as far as we could see from the air, and there were probably not more than 24 landing boats smashed on the shore. Some units of our marine forces have secured about two-thirds of the airfield in the south, and I could see our tanks lumbering along its 5,000-foot runway. On the western side of the airfield, the battle was still raging and was centered around the large volcanic depression wherein the Japs are entrenched. Our tanks had this area almost entirely surrounded, and we could see them shooting it up. Farther north, in the middle of the island, the Japs seemed to be dug in along the runways of airfield number 2 and have barricaded themselves behind revetments on the field itself. They are very hard to spot, even from our low altitude, since they're almost entirely underground. They would have to be, since nobody could stand the tremendous plastering that that island is taking if they had been on the surface. A group of planes had been circling the area at low altitude for several minutes, and I heard one of the pilots say, "Let's bomb this thing and get out of here. We're shot full of hell." At no time could I see our carrier fleet, but they must have been all around the area, since the planes seemed to be coming in from all different directions. By this time, I too thought it might be a good idea if we got out of there, and suggested the same to our pilot, Lieutenant John Brooks of Ireland. We made one more photographic run along the entire length of Iwo Jima and left. As we got several miles away, I could see a great pall of smoke and dust hanging over the entire island to a distance of almost 1,000 feet. The Battle of Iwo Jima will be recorded as one of the most savage ever fought by the United States Marines. We were only 20 miles south of Iwo Jima when a Grumman Avenger pulled up alongside our Liberator. The pilot stuck out his bronze head, grinned, and jerked his right thumb up in front of him. It's that packy, confident signal of the airman that everything's going to be okay. This is Arthur Prem speaking for the Combined American Network after a D+1 flight over Iwo Jima in the volcanoes.
Those zany aviators, right? Pulling up next to him, giving him the thumbs up. Back in the day when you could do that without getting your arm ripped off. This is an interview done with, I think, a Marine colonel that was the first interview done with somebody that was on the ground there.
We are delaying the start of our scheduled program to bring you a special CBS World News broadcast. For an interview with an eyewitness to the fighting on Iwo Jima, the first man back from that island, we take you to CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
The first man back from the great battle with Iwo Jima is sitting before the CBS microphone in the Navy Department in Washington. He is Lieutenant Commander John W. McClain, who is in charge of naval photographers at Iwo Jima. The commander has been flying 3 days and has spent 4 days and nights without sleep. He's still dressed in his tan fatigue uniform with an old leather jacket. Commander, the American people have been deeply stirred by the great battle at Tokyo's front door. Suppose you tell us something about it.
Well, on D-Day, I was in a landing ship, an LCI. In pretty close range, it seemed too close at times. I saw the whole show from the Navy bombardment up until the time I left.
What was this Navy bombardment like?
I had a good seat for the show, and I can tell you I never saw such a bombardment in my life. I saw the landings in Africa and Normandy, and they can't compare with the concentration from the sea and carrier-based planes. It was hard to believe that any human being could be left alive on the island after that naval fire. It had its effect, too. When the first waves of Marines went ashore, the Japs were stunned. There was only meager fire from the enemy, and it was a magnificent sight, all the landing ships lined up along the beaches and out to sea, and the Marines pulling their way through the deep volcanic ash headed for the airfield in the middle of the island.
Can you tell us something about the island and the Jap defenses, Commander?
Well, if you'd set out to build an impregnable fortress, you couldn't do any better than copy Iwo Jima. Mount Suribachi at the southern tip of the island is a junior Gibraltar. It stands more than 500 feet high and the sides are packed with caves and hidden gun emplacements. This mountain commands the entire island. The southern end of the island is a mass of caves and ravines and underground pillboxes, and the beaches are volcanic sand. It impedes even walking and makes the movement of heavy equipment very difficult. The Jap guns had control of the entire beach area where our men had to land. From the landing ship, I could see great plumes of water spurt high in the air from Japanese fire coming from both directions. In the initial landings, the Marines took the edge of the beach. The Jap coastal guns had been knocked out by naval gunfire. The first three waves that went in were landing craft tanks that nosed right up to the beach. They were followed by Higgins boats. It was less than an hour after the naval bombardment ended that the Japs opened up with all their machine guns, mortars, and artillery. They'd recovered from their daze by then. Their guns from Mount Suribachi in the area to the south zeroed the beaches. Must have been hell on the beaches when that Jap fire began. And you'll remember the first waves met with little opposition. We could see the Marines digging in when the Japs opened up.
Did it take the Marines long to reform their lines and start the attack again, Commander?
No, they were stuck a few hundred yards inland until about noon. Then in the afternoon, they began to advance with tanks. We saw the tanks fan out and move up toward the high ground with the Marines following right behind them on foot. All the time, naval gunfire and airstrikes were giving them close support.
What kind of seas did you have for the invasion, Commander?
Well, the first day was swell. The seas were fairly calm. But the next day, the sky was ugly and overcast, and the waves began piling up. That, of course, made the job of landing supplies and reinforcements tough. After a day of fighting, the beaches were a picture of desolation. The litter and debris of war was all around, damaged landing ships, equipment, and weapons.
Commander, what kind of air support did the Marines get during the invasion?
Carrier planes were coming in all the time for strikes. There wasn't a moment when the air was free of planes. Dive bombers came right down on the deck. Rockets and bombs were smashing at the Japs. The noise of the planes and the shore fire was terrific.
Commander, how did you manage to get out of Iwo Jima?
Well, that's a story in itself. I went from the landing craft to a Navy PBM on D+1. At the time, we were in the PBM trying to get off. Anti-aircraft batteries were firing at us. I couldn't see how we were going to get in the air, but the pilot calmly said, "We've got a little gadget here that'll get us off." It was jet propulsion. He pressed a red button, and we shot 40 feet in the air. From there, we flew to Saipan, Guam, and then home nonstop.
For those of you who don't know, a PB, what do you call it, PBY, PBN? Anyway, it's one of those, they were long-range aircraft that did patrolling, but they can land, capable of landing in the water. So they did what's called a jet-assisted takeoff out of the water. So they wouldn't have to, right, go try to pick up speed and stay in the water for a long time. They did a little jet-assisted thing. I had never heard that until I heard this.
I arrived here 4 hours ago.
Thank you, Commander McLean. I return you to CBS in New York.
You know, the other thing that's interesting is, you know, how different the world is in terms of the media, right? I mean, that obviously that was the official Department of War statement on Iwo Jima, something that you would never... You know, you would never have now, as the reporters filed their own reports and did not rely heavily on spokesmen. I want to play for you. The audio for of my friend Tom Clifford. All right, you heard some of the audio of 4th Tank Battalion that where they were shooting a guy behind a tree and things like that. This is them on the beach. No call signs, in the clear, using each other's names. Awesome.
Hello, Dick. Hello, Dick. This is Steve. Over. Is that you, Hammy? Over. Paul Kelliger, this is Steve. Come on ahead. Over.
Steve's having comm issues.
Paul Bell. Hello, Bill. This is Steve. Over. All right, Bill, look to your right if you can. And you'll have to see if you can work through those sticks now. They have them marked, and Pearson and Clifford went through those. Over.
Yeah, Clifford is my friend, Tom Clifford, who passed away. I don't know, Tom might have passed away 5 years ago. Now, here's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get off the beach and get up to the airfield to support the infantry attack because it's all flat up there, right? Tanks own that stuff until somebody starts shooting at them. Then they got to scoot, find, haul up later or hide a little bit. Tom Clifford is 8-Ball. That's the name of his tank. All their call signs, because they were Alpha Company, 4th Tank Battalion, started with A. So Applejack, 8-Ball, A-I-G-H-T, right? So that's them.
Hello, Steve. Hello, Steve. This is Tom. Over. I just talked to Jumpa Joe, and he said that what he knows, they're supposed to be within 100 yards of the airstrip. Over. We must be right around up here someplace, Steve. There isn't a hell of a lot of infantry here. You know where that's? Those poles are right on the edge of the airstrip, and we're not about 150 to 200 yards away from them. Over. Roger, Tom. You say your 300s are not working, nor can you contact any infantry. Over. We try to come. Roger, Tom. Able 3, this is Able 1. Over. Hello, Steve, this is Dick. Over again, please. Go ahead, Dick, over. Say, is that all fixed to me yet? No, it has not, and I'm sure waiting on it here sitting in this hole, over. Okay, Steve, when you get out of that hole, you know where the hell I'm at up here. I need to come up here and put this tank back on to fix this damn tank up.
Through a track. Not good. All right, that's 4th Tank Battalion. Yeah, imagine small world of small worlds. He had never heard that since that day, so I didn't tell him I had it. I asked him, it was probably this week, a number of years ago, to come on the program, and would he mind talking about Iwo Jima and his time in the Pacific? He said no, so he comes on, and I said, listen to this and tell me what's going on here. And I play it, and he was sitting there, and he listened to it. It was almost like his eyes glossed over as he listened to it, you know, as he remembered that day. And when it got done playing, he just looked at me, and he said, I said, have you heard that? And he looked at me and he said, not since the day it happened. He said, where the hell did you get that? And, yeah, pretty amazing. The last Iwo Jima piece before the gunner comes on that we'll do is, this is the Secretary of Navy, James Forrestal, who was off the coast of Iwo Jima.
We delay the music of the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra to bring you a special report by the Secretary of the Navy, James B. Forrestal, speaking from Guam. This report was transcribed within the hour via special military facilities.
Up the precipitous side of a 600-foot extinct volcano, so precipitous that it seemed almost vertical, went a platoon of American Marines. Even through a glass, they seemed tiny figures scrambling skyward against a background of blue. And then a few minutes later, from the thousands of throats upon ships and on land and sea, came the sudden cry, there goes the flag. That was how the Stars and Stripes went up on the first island of Japan's outer rim of island defenses. It was at 11 o'clock, Friday, February 23rd. We saw that flag going up halfway on the journey to shore with Lieutenant General Hans Smith of the United States Marines. It was the high point in a week of hard fighting, fighting which continues and will continue for some days to come. The Japs don't want to lose Iwo Jima. It's the first step in a sequence of doom for their homeland. They have put into it every kind of defense, and they have had years to plan that defense. As you know by now, Iwo Jima is a tiny island, 5 miles by 2.5, coming to a tapering point at its southern end. Its terrain, unlike that of some other atolls we have taken, rises some distance from the sea. Mount Suribachi, where our flag went up on Thursday, being its highest point. Its beaches are soft volcanic ash, so loose and crumbling that one Marine said it was like trying to dig a foxhole in a bag of wheat. The Japs took full and skillful advantage of that terrain and of the fact that there could be no tactical surprise as to where an enemy would land. We had to land on the beaches we did land on, and it had to be a frontal assault. They had planted mortars, rocket gun emplacements, and artillery all over that grim and barren island, so that there were streams of converging fire at the beachhead over which the Marines had to come scrambling in from the sea. The Japs, as they had done at Tarawa and at Kwajalein and at Saipan and Guam, had deep burrows under the shelving ridges of Mount Suribachi and caves along the rising shoreline to the north. Some of these caves had connecting galleries, and they will be digging dead Japs and some live Japs even out of them probably for many weeks to come. But in spite of all the skill of the Japanese defense, the Marines went ashore, and they have exacted since a 4-to-1 toll in death from our enemies. America is on the march in the Pacific, a march back to civilization, order, and decency. You can see it in islands like Guam and Saipan. The way back is being cleared by fighting men from every state in our Union. Blue Jackets, Marines, soldiers, and airmen. You can be confident of them, of the battle airmen who have done a tremendous job in this Iwo Jima operation, of the Marines, the Army Air Forces, and you can be confident of their leaders, of men like Fleet Admiral Nimitz, Vice Admiral Turner, Lieutenant General Harmon, Lieutenant General Holland Smith, Major General LeMay of the 21st Bomber Command, and finally, of that glorious aggregation of fighting men, the 5th Amphibious Corps of the Marines, which under Lieutenant General Harry Schmidt's direction is leading the fighting at Iwo Jima. It is a great team, and Americans can be proud of it, and of the country that produced them.
We return you to the United States.
All right, we're going to take a break. Mike Musselman joins us next. He's fired up for some reason this morning. We'll find out more about that. I'll bring you more audio from not only the period, which I find extremely interesting, but also oral histories of guys who fought there. Most of them have now passed away. I mean, think about it. If you were 20, 77 years ago, you would be 92 today. So not too many of them left anymore, but there are. They're around. So, don't touch that dial. Gunner joins us next.